Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. I get sent a lot of books from publishers wanting their authors to appear on the show, but only the very best and most interesting make it to air and podcast on our program. One of the most interesting and fun reads I've had in a long time is the new book by award-winning British author Simon Barnes, titled A History of the World in 100 Animals. Barnes was the chief sports writer for the Times of London, and in that role, traveled the world to cover major sports stories from the World Cup to the Super Bowl. While on his travels, he often sought out natural places to connect with nature and wild creatures, especially birds. His fascination with birds and animals became a passion and led to two previous books, The Meaning of Birds and How to Be a Bad Bird Watcher. In his new book, Barnes widens his scope to talk about animals that have shaped human history and, conversely, how we are impacting them. The overall message is one of ecological awareness, that we are not alone on this planet, but that we share it with an incredible but increasingly threatened diversity of life. The author and naturalist joins us from his home in Norfolk, England, near some of the most precious ecological lands in the UK, the Norfolk Marshes. Simon Barnes, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's good to be here.
Well, before we get into the book in detail, I'd just like to know, you know, it's obvious from looking at this book and your other titles that you're in your life that you deeply love nature and exploring the wilds and all kinds of different critters, birds in particular. Where did this come from for you? When did you first really know that you were passionate about studying the wild world?
It was a boyhood thing. Initially, partly because of my father, partly because of myself. I was very much self-driven. When I was a boy at the age of 10, I used to get the 49 bus across London to the Natural History Museum every Saturday. It was before the days of paedophilia phobia, so it was considered perfectly acceptable for a 10-year-old boy to go out like that. And I would spend every Saturday in the museum, marveling at the bones and the skins and at the wildlife, at the extraordinary range of creatures there are that we share the planet with. And that had me enthralled right from then. Then I went through being a teenager and all that kind of stuff and didn't forget about that stuff. Always had a great nostalgia for it. But then when I was 30, I was traveling in Sri Lanka and went to a wild place and was absolutely lit up. I was born again. I was saying, why have I ever looked away from this? This is the best stuff in the world, and I will never, ever leave it again.
So you grew up in the city then, as a childhood, yeah. You were a city child. And I know from my own experience that when you are growing up in that urban kind of a setting, I grew up in part of the time in suburban Southern California near Los Angeles. When you do get out into those wild areas, and you know, for me, it wasn't too far away to find that, but it was a revelation of just getting away from the constant beehive buzz of the city and out into the quiet and the sounds of nature. As a kid, that had a profound effect on me. And there's something about connecting to the natural world that this book really, you know, it reinforced that for me.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that it did. No, I've spent a lot of my time traveling across to the cities of the world from the other part of my life, which is writing about sport, very often in America. And one of the things I would always do as soon as I arrived in a city for any time was to ring up the local Audubon Society and get to speak to somebody. Said, where can I go? By taxi, if I've got half a day off, if I've got a day off. And they were always great help. And they said, well, you could always do this. And so, wherever I was able to have a little bit of adventure, get a bit of a hit of nature, get out of the city and do something a bit green. Even did that in New York.
Can you think of one of those on one of your travels through to a city where it was just like, wow, this is amazing that I can find this place, you know, not far from the city?
I covered the Super Bowl in San Diego in, I think, 1990, but I may have got that slightly wrong. And It was 1988, that matters. It was, I flew over from Atlantic City, where I've been watching a punch-up with Mike Tyson. And then I went across and in San Diego, I was able to get boats out to watch the gray whale migration. I'd never seen the big whales before. And seeing these whales break the surface, it was the most extraordinary thing because they breathe. I mean, they breathe the air like us. You've got this enormous sea, and then something comes up and it breathes like us, the breathtaking breath. And I thought, this is just absolutely wonderful. And then a few days later, after the Super Bowl, I was flying further up the coast to spend some days at the racetrack in LA. And so I was flying up the coast where I, over the sea, looking down, wondering if I could see any great whales. And I said to myself, I want to write those whales. I want to write this. I have to start writing about wildlife. It's not something I do in my spare time. It's something I do with my life. I've got to do this more. And I did.
Wow. And whales are definitely in this book. And one of my favorite passages was about the blue whale, which is just the most astonishing creature.
It absolutely is. I mean, I'd seen whales, not just the gray whales. I'd seen the humpbacks, a few others here and there. But I'd always wanted, of course, to see a blue whale. Who doesn't want to see a blue whale? And so I went to Sri Lanka did so. And there was one that came up right by the boat in the most obliging way possible. And shall I tell you something extraordinary?
Sure.
It was huge. I mean, it was very, very big.
People think dinosaurs were the biggest things ever on Earth, but that's not true.
That's not true. And your brain doesn't want to process this information. You just look at it and say, it can't be that big. It can't be that big, but it is. And it's bigger and it starts to dive. And it goes on and it goes on and it goes on, siphoning its way past you and getting slimmer and slimmer and slimmer until you get just before the tail flukes. And you see, this is not just huge. This is an incredibly graceful creature as well. And then the tail flukes go up in the air and you cheer. You can't help but cheer. A cheer is torn from your throat and down it goes. And you think, that's the most wonderful thing in the universe I've just seen.
Yes, and even if an encounter with any kind of whale is quite an experience, although the blue whale is, you know, the largest creature ever on Earth, so that says it all right there.
It has a certain cachet, doesn't it?
Yes.
Something that you're not going to shake off.
But any whale encounter is really a magical thing. I can remember as a young person living part-time in Malibu in Southern California and taking a little skiff or my surfboard out into the kelp beds and out beyond, just kind of to hang out and just be out there in the ocean because it was just easy to do. And once in a while, you know, the whales would come through and they would just go gliding by, and you know, never felt afraid around them. In fact, I always felt safer when the whales were there.
So just you and the whales, sounds like a very fine experience.
And wonderful. And then always very sad if I'd find one dead on the beach.
Oh God, yeah.
It was just horrible. Okay, let's talk about this book. What made you decide to do this in terms of, I'm going to tell a history of the world in terms of 100 animals? What was the genesis for that?
Yeah, the seed germinated when I was in Armenia doing some work for a conservation organization. We were looking at this wonderful land in the Caucasus Mountains, and we started up the day in a wild rose garden. So we went up through alpine meadows, and then I was sitting on the top of the mountain with the beautiful little plants of limestone pavements all around me, and I could hear the occasional rattle of stones that meant there was a Bezoa goat on one of the ledges. I could look down and see Lammergeier vultures, the most enormous creatures. And this was a kind of a heady, rich experience. And as I sat there, I just was thinking about, you know, why is it that we think the entire world is only about humans or if we separate it and you say it's wildlife, you talk about the wild world as if it's quite separate from the world that we live in every day. There's only one world, and there's us on it and quite a lot of other species as well. And what's more, these species have impacted on our history just as our histories have impacted on theirs. And I thought, well, I can tell stories from this point of view. I have to tell the stories as to how this is going to go. And so I resolved to try and do that. And I was lucky enough that Simon and Schuster thought, yeah, let's go for it. Let's go for it. Let's make a nice big fat book with lots of pictures and not just photograph, you know, wildlife photographs, but of pictures that show the history, show the length of time in which the human species has coexisted with all these other species and what they've done to us and what we've done to them and how it's been basically an shared adventure between all the species involved.
Yes, I love the paintings. For example, one that pops to mind is you have a chapter on Tyrannosaurus rex, mm-hmm. which is, as you point out, it's like the one scientific name that everybody knows, you know, of animals. And there's this wonderful painting from the Field Museum in there of the classic T-Rex with the Triceratops. And it's just so iconic.
Yes, well, no doubt. When you were 10, you too had a book that you open up and showed these reconstructions of these giants.
Oh, sure.
The same world that we live in, but quite different, with these different creatures in it. And yeah, my book was called The Golden Treasury of Natural History by a lady called Bertha Morris Parker. And a few years ago, I managed to retrace a copy because mine had long gone red to shreds, and saw it again and revisited these pictures. And yes, returning to that world, the world of childhood and of the childhood imagination, and imagining those times gone past, those times that lasted for 100 million years. There's something that for humanity to aim at, eh?
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that I really want to ask you about is how do you arrive at your final list of 100 animals? Because, of course, there are more than that on Earth. But you come up with your list, and it's a wonderful list because it's representative of all kinds of things. And how did you come up with that? I'm imagining you with a bunch of index cards with animals on them. You got 300 and you got I got to get this down to 100.
Exactly. It was all about scribbling lists in notebooks, and the final running order wasn't actually certain until I was in the 90s, because I was discarding some and adding others and so forth. And I reckon I could do another 100 easily enough of creatures whose lives have overlapped with ours, but perhaps I'll leave that one for someone else.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we'll continue our fascinating look at some of the incredible creatures on our planet with Simon Barnes, the British journalist and author of A History of the World in 100 Animals. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with British author Simon Barnes. His new book, A History of the World in 100 Animals, is a collection of essays on animals, both wild and domestic, that have both shaped and been impacted by human civilization. One of the things I love about this book, and I hope you'll take this as a compliment, is to me, this is like the ultimate bathroom book.
Yes.
Because you can just, have it there, and while you're contemplating the universe on your throne, you can just open to any page, randomly, and you're on an adventure.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's sort of horizontal axis. You can read it vertically, but you can also read it horizontally. There's a nice picture on just about every page. And you can just say, that's a nice picture. Why is that picture in there? What does that mean? And then, yeah, God willing, it strikes a spark and you're off again.
Yeah, and what I like about that method is you might look at the list and go, oh, there's one of my favorite animals. I'm going to go read that part. But what was fun is like opening to a page like, for example, I did this the other day, barnacle. And, I wouldn't have thought, you know, if I was coming up with a list of 100 things, I would not have thought of barnacles. But you did. And I'd like you to explain why barnacles in there.
Well, the first reason for turning to barnacles was because of Charles Darwin. And Charles Darwin has always been a major hero of mine. And so I've read a great deal about him, not just about the conclusions that he reached, but how he got there and what sort of a man he was. And what happened with Darwin was that he was a gentleman scientist. He had a gentleman adventure. He was in the category of the brilliant amateur. And he was having a correspondence with his old friend Joseph Hooker, the botanist, who was very much the hard-bitten pro. And as a result of their correspondence, they were discussing a book. And Darwin said, I think there's a lot in this. And Hooker said, you can't take that guy seriously. He's never done any proper work on species. And Darwin said, well, he was mortified. He was mortified. He was absolutely cut to the quick because he hadn't done intense work on species. And so he had this great idea nurturing the back of his mind, but everyone would take it. Oh, yes, it's just a bit of a jeu d'esprit. It's a bit of a firework from this amateur. So he devoted 8 years of his life to the study and the classification of barnacles, and he was absolutely enthralled with them. My beloved barnacles, he called them. And by the time he'd finished that, he had serious, proper street cred as a scientist, on the subject of species. And his work still holds good to this day. It was praised at the time for being a beautiful work of science. And having done that, having got that on his CV, he was serious, he was proper, he was pro. So when he finally published On the Origin of Species, which explained how evolution works, he had to be taken seriously, he had to be listened to, and indeed he was.
And barnacles are interesting anatomically, physiologically, because they look like kind of like a shellfish or something like that, but they're not.
Absolutely. They are more closely related to the butterfly that flies across the beach incongruously than the shellfish, the mollusks that are next to them on the rocks. They are, in fact, related to the arthropods, and they are very good at sticking to stuff, and then from there they waft the food into their mouths. And that ability to stick has made them a problem for just about everybody who has ever tried to make a go of crossing the oceans.
Well, on the opposite side of the spectrum of a creature that really does loom large in our collective psyche is the one that kicks off the book, and that's lion. And I was fascinated reading it to think about how we as a species evolved amongst lions, and you know, our collective safety, you know, depended on our dealing with the fact that, you know, we were not the apex predators.
Absolutely not. We were just one prey species among others. There is a set of ancient preserved footprints at the Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania, the place basically where humankind was born. This is where the first humans walked upright and began to work by hunting and gathering across the open savannas. And these are not only ancient, but they are incomparably moving, because you can see a large set of footprints and alongside it small footprints, an adult and a young, a human and a child. and they're walking side by side. And it doesn't take a huge leap of the imagination to say, but the adult was holding the child's hand, wasn't he? Isn't that possibly what he, what she was doing? Just as I used to, my father used to say to me, hold my hand crossing Lucas Street when I was going to infant school as a boy. You hold the hand of a child because it's dangerous. Savannas of Africa are dangerous. I've walked miles and miles across the savannas of Africa and have never for a second been unaware of the danger. It's all around you. You walk there, as I've walked many times in the Luangwa Valley in Zambia, and you are aware of lions all around you. I have walked with lions. I have had close encounters with lions, and that's gone very, very deep with me. And I can see that one of the most important thing that happened was as humans learnt to walk across the savannas, to live in the savannas, was to avoid predation, was to avoid lions, was to not be eaten. That was perhaps the first triumph of humankind, was not being eaten.
And it's interesting too, in your section on lions, how much importance they have in human civilization as a symbol, hearkening back to that time, and power, the power of the lion in heraldry, in the Bible and Christianity. I found that fascinating too.
Yeah, I think the reason for that is that lions are very, very obviously sexually dimorphic. That is to say that the males look very, very different from the females. Not the case with our own species, but lions look radically different from the females because they have a huge mane. And to human eyes, it looks a bit like a crown. We like to think of a male lion as the king of the jungle, the king of all he surveys, the creature to whom all others must give way. And so we have kings take the names of lions. In England, most famously, we had Richard the Lionheart, who went to the Crusades and fought there. And lions are important in Britain and these days. They're important to us all because they're symbols of ferocity. You've got the Detroit Lions for a start.
Yes. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, sparrows. Because I'm looking outside my window watching some little white-crowned sparrows feed outside my window right now. And why did you choose them?
Sparrows have got this extraordinary affinity for living alongside humans. It was something that developed very, very early on, I suspect. They are adept at taking on food that we waste, and that taking it, spilled grain is one of the great things. Agriculture is about 12,000 years old. Human permanent settlements are probably about the same sort of age. So when we had those, we needed places to store food, to store grain. Naturally, we spilt it. The great thing about sparrows is that they are small and they are versatile, and they were able to adapt their behavior to work with humans and then to nest in thatches and various other parts of human dwellings. And so they have grown and lived alongside us from those early days right into the 19th century, when cities were powered by horses rather than the internal combustion engine. So horses need fuel. Fuel comes in the form of grain. Grain gets spilt. London was a city of sparrows. It was absolutely ubiquitous bird, common as sparrows, people said. So sparrows have shared our living spaces for thousands of years.
And you obviously love birds because you've got two other titles in your catalog that refer to birds. You have a book called The Meaning of Birds, and my favorite title is How to Be a Bad Bird Watcher. Tell me a bit about your fascination with birds.
Yeah, I think the first thing about birds is they fly. You've possibly noticed that, and you've possibly noticed that you can't. And wouldn't it be great to fly? think the next thing with birds will see in four colours. So they're often brightly coloured and beautiful themselves. Very few mammals have any colours worth bothering with. They're all browns and blacks and so forth. But birds exist in bright colours as if it was there to please the eye. They're not there to please us. They're there to please each other. But that's what they do. The other thing that birds have a highly developed sense of is hearing. They're very, very good at hearing, and therefore they are also very, very good at making sounds. In fact, they don't just fly and look beautiful, they sing, they make beautiful music. And in fact, it's my belief that they were instrumental in teaching humans what music is, and that when we wanted music, we got it from the birds.
I never thought about the connection really to music, but now that you mention it, it seems quite natural. The Dawn Chorus, you know, was probably our first symphony.
Yeah, exactly. The first instruments that we made were bird flutes. You'd have thought the most obvious instruments to make were sort of xylophones or things like that. But no, we made bird flutes, made them from hollow bones. And they go back several thousand, you know, I think the oldest is the Diefenbaker flute, which I think is 45,000 years old. When we want music, we turn to the birds. We had rhythm, we got rhythm in our blood. We spend the first 9 months of our existence listening to the 4-4 beat of our mothers. But so we naturally have rhythm, but melody we pinch from the birds, and we put that together, rhythm and melody together, and made what we now call music.
Oh, and I can hear some birds in the background. That's lovely.
Yeah, you can. So it sounds like a garden warbler. Oh. That's quite an exciting one.
Oh, nice. Well, right on cue. Tell them the bird seeds in the mail.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thanks for the appearance on the show. Right on time.
No, very good. Excellent. Very good. I'll appreciate.
And, you know, while we're on the subject of birds, there are a couple of birds that fascinate me. They kind of get a bad rap, are the jays and crows. You know, we even call a gathering of crows a murder of crows. You know, they kind of have a bad rap. But they're so intelligent.
It is indeed. I mean, we're humans. We're pretty smart as species go, and we tend to have a special admiration, affection for other species that have intelligence, like dolphins and the great whales, like elephants, like the great apes. We value that. There's the great Aesop fable of the thirsty crow. The crow was very thirsty, and there was some liquid, some water available, but it was only in a thin glass, and his beak didn't reach far enough down. So he picked up pebbles and put them in the jar until the water level was high enough for him to drink. Sounds like a nice fable and all that, but it has been replicated. Professor Nikki Clayton has replicated it, not by making her crows desperately thirsty, which would be unethical, but by floating a beautiful delicacy, if you happen to be a jay, which is a species of crow, in water, but again in a narrow jar that the jay can't reach. Then the jay looks at it and says, right, I fancy that worm, I can crack this. The pebbles supplied, put the pebbles in, get the wax worm. So you say, okay, you think you're smart. How about this styrofoam? Let's put the styrofoam in and see if that works. Won't even touch it. Picks it up. That's not going to work, is it? Because, crows are good at deductive reasoning. There is a species of crow in Japan that has evolved the behavior of chucking nuts on the roadway so that cars will run over it and act as nutcrackers for them. And that's pretty smart. But they have refined this method, and now they will, when they can, they will drop it on pedestrian crossings. So when the stoplight goes on and the traffic's halted, they will be able to pick the nuts out without any danger of getting struck themselves. So yes, crows are to be respected. They are smart.
Well, and speaking of things like that, our producer Matt Fidler has a question for you, Simon, regarding some interesting animal experiences with birds he's been having lately.
So you talked about how the jays are related to crows. And I'm just wondering if you have some personal advice for me, who had some blue jays make a nest and have some little chicks right in my yard, just a couple feet away from my garden beds. And like crows, blue jays seem to be very protective parents. And one of the blue jays, I assume it's the dad, but maybe it's the mom, keeps on swooping at me whenever I'm gardening and like comes really close to me. Well, so a two-part question. Is it possible that they could give me some sort of disease if it ever broke the skin? That's what I'm concerned about. Then my second part is there a way I can convince them that I'm not going to harm their chicks and that I'm safe?
To the first question, I think you'd have to be dead unlucky. If they're going to get you with the claws on the end, it would be just like scratching yourself on a rose thorn while you're gardening. You know, that's nothing to worry about as long as you clean it and plaster it afterwards.
Good to do. Okay.
In terms of telling the Blue Jays you mean no harm, I would say the best thing you could do is to just be in your garden and be still and unthreatening. So you're probably a kind of get on and do stuff sort of guy,
I'm swinging a pick if I'm or something, or I'm doing maybe violent actions or that are looked upon as violent actions.
It's disconcerting. So why not bring out a folding chair and your cup of coffee or a beer, depending what end of the day it is.
Just sit there.
And yeah, exactly that. Just sit there, be quiet. You know, I mean no harm. I'm just sharing the space with you. I'm absolutely not a threat. They are smart.
What if I went one step further and brought out some birdseed or something too?
Yeah, that would make you a food source, and that could be compromising. It can be done. I've seen people do it with smaller birds. I would not personally recommend it to do casually.
Okay.
With a big bird like that, but just not be a threat, and and wear a hat.
Yeah, I've learned to wear a hat because it was disconcerting when I could feel the wings against my hair. It got that close to me.
Yes, well, it's a fairly atavistic fear, isn't it? There's something coming to get you out of the sky.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Stephen King fan, so it was a little frightening.
Yeah, I have jays in my yard, and I feed all of our birds. They know, the jays know me, really. It's like we have a personal relationship, because like the other birds, the migratory birds, they'll feed, and then they leave as soon as I come out. The jays hang out, because they're like, oh yeah, this is our guy. This is our guy that feeds us and provides water. He's cool.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely. They're smart. They're not to be underestimated.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with award-winning journalist and author Simon Barnes. His new book, A History of the World in 100 Animals, is out now from Pegasus Books. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our visit with British author Simon Barnes as we talk about his new book, A History of the World in 100 Animals. He joined us recently from his home in Norfolk, England. Now let's talk about some animals that are really deeply embedded in human culture and our lives. The domesticated animals like dogs, cats, sheep, horses. Let's start out with cats and dogs.
Yes, I mean, the great thing about a dog is that it's a wolf. It's the same species as a wolf. Your poodle, your Yorkshire Terrier, your little handbag dog that you take if you're a lady who lunches, they're all wolves. They are absolutely wolves. You say, well, you couldn't take a wolf into your house. You would if it was a puppy, because the puppies are charming. And so over the centuries, the millennia, we have bred from these wolves into selecting for friendliness, niceness, and docility. There was an experiment done in Siberia with foxes, actually, rather than with wolves, but they were selectively bred for their niceness, for their kindness, for their puppyishness. And within a very few generations, they stopped looking foxy. They got floppy ears and mottled coats and generally looked and behaved very different. And this was within the space of a human lifetime. So over multiple lifetimes, we can get a wolf that looks like a Yorkshire Terrier. We have decided to have wolves in our sitting rooms, in our houses, to share our lives with. And why do we do that? Because of love. I think initially, of course, for security, because they bark, because the dogs bark when there's somebody around. So if you've got dogs around you, then they're going to go woof when wild animals or wild people are going to sneak up on you. So you've got a warning, but you have them in the house and you start to like them. And so these days we have dogs. Some dogs work, plenty of dogs work, but mostly most dogs, their job is to love and to be loved. And not a lot wrong with that.
Yeah. And then you have cats, and there seems to be, although there are people who like both, they're either dog people or cat people, people that really love dogs or really love cats. Cats are a different animal altogether.
It's a strange thing, isn't it? Yeah. People love cats because cat will tell you to get lost. Dogs are basically intensely social animals. They look to a leader to placate. They want to have that. They're very aware of the hierarchy and their place in it, which is lower than that of the humans all around, of the humans on which they are dependent. So the dog's job is constantly to placate the human. And that's a very nice thing, to have a dog come up and fawn on you and make nice and enjoy being stroked, being given the favor by the pack leader and so forth. Cats don't see the world like that. They don't see the world in hierarchy. They see the world as in what's in it for them. And they have this strong streak of independence that people admire. I've always loved the story by Rudyard Kipling of the cat that walked by himself, waving his wild tail and walking on his wild lone. And yes, I've always loved that aspect of cats, that they will play the part of being your best friend, and then they'll get bored with it and go out and do their own stuff.
Yes, and speaking of birds, they're also a terror for wild birds.
Indeed, I don't have cats where I live now because I live surrounded by marshland and wild birds, and to have a predator who doesn't need to hunt, but a predator hunting merely for the sport of it would upset the balance of it. So yes, one must be responsible with the animals one takes into one's care.
And then sheep. I would not have thought about sheep as being something dynamic and interesting to read about, but they really have they're so woven, if you will, metaphor, into the fabric of civilization.
Yeah, well, for a start, they're actually quite easy to keep. I mean, a sheep farmer will tell you that a sheep from birth has one ambition, and that is to die. But they are comparatively low maintenance animals to keep, and they are comparatively unfierce. It's when you can think of a bull with a ram, yeah, you know which one you'd sooner deal with. They're small and they're very, very herdy. So they're very easy to organize. They will stick together no matter what they do. They're also very good for working in dry country, and that's made them a very important animal in West Asia, and that is where Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all sprung up. So it's hardly surprising that the idea of sheep has crept very deeply into those traditions, Christians will traditionally have lamb at Easter time. We talk about Jesus as the Lamb of God, the sacrifice that must be made so that the celebration, so that everything will be all right again. Sheep are as deep in our culture as any other creature that ever breathed.
And you know, and many of the figures in the Bible were shepherds.
Absolutely, that's absolutely true. They were the first people to see the infant Jesus was the shepherds leaving the sheep on the hillside to come down. A beautiful story on which all those brought up in the Christian tradition know very, very well.
Okay, and then another animal very intertwined with civilization, but vastly different, and one of my favorite creatures, horses.
Yeah, it's been suggested that sort of the history of humanity shouldn't we be defined by the tools that we use, you know, stone, iron, bronze, and so forth, but the uses to which we put our horses, using them first as food and subsequently as transport, and then for warfare, and then for mass transit, and so forth. Horses have made it possible for humans to expand their ideas initially to make us more mobile. If you have a horse and it's fit and you can water it, you can cover 100 miles in a day without too much problem. And you can also carry stuff with a horse, doubled or trebled what you can, the distance you can work and what you can carry. Horses allowed humans to expand and to move with purpose, to make contact with other humans, to trade with them, to wage war with them. And so we've used horses for those purposes ever since. And we're using them for warfare as late as the First World War, when my grandfather was working in the, was a soldier in the horse artillery.
Yes. And I was like imagining what it must have been like, because there had to be a first time. There had to be a first time that a human being decided, I'm going to get on the back of this animal and ride it.
Well, you would. Okay, let's remember the horses. We're not talking about 17-hand Hanoverian shows.
No, they were more like ponies.
Exactly. You got something like a pony that is maybe 12, 13 hands, something not much higher than your hip. And you keep them for you can eat them, you can kill them, and you can eat them, and that's good to have them around. And your job and your mate's job is to look after you. You've got to look after the horses today and make sure they don't stray. And it's a long day, and your mate says to you, "You couldn't get on the back of that, could you?" You say, "Yo, oh yeah, oh yeah. You want to see?" And so you do. Just vault on. And you probably vault straight back off again, but no worries. It's begun, the process began. It's a natural thing to do. And when you start to be able to do selective breeding, you choose the horses that are nicest to ride, and you don't breed from the ones who chuck you off every time. So over time, you've got horses that will accept a rider, but still keep enough wildness in them, so you've got a bit of speed in them as well.
Yeah, so it's so fascinating to think about these animals that have become a part of our civilization that we have domesticated. Let's go back to the wild things. And one of the things that people tend to not care for very much, and that's spiders. I mean, I know there are people who love spiders and are fascinated by them and study them. But for the most people I know, when they see a spider, their reaction is, ew.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a strange thing because it's there. I mean, obviously it can be unpleasant, but they're not life threatening. Makes far more sense to be frightened of a 10-ton truck. But that's curious, atavistic terror that's from nowhere. It's to do, I think, with a strange movement. I mean, it's been suggested that it comes to you culturally. Well, in my household, nobody was frightened of spiders. My mother's terrified of mice, but was comparatively relaxed about spiders. I've got no problem with mice, but spiders And the other theory is that it's an atavistic response to danger because spiders are dangerous, but they're not very, very, very few are going to kill you. There's going to be, you can be worse, mildly inconvenienced. I mean, people are not, don't have cringing terror of lions, and lions are really quite dangerous.
Much more dangerous.
But not a spider. My feeling is it's because spiders move in a curious way, a way that doesn't really fit our templates of how they should, how things should move. It's unfamiliar. And in the unfamiliarity, there is always the possibility of danger. Something unfamiliar, potential danger, keep clear of it.
Well, I'd like to finish up with some creatures that are very important to the entire Earth, and as they all are, but especially to humanity, that we really are starting to realize that we are messing up the world for them. And those are the pollinators. You have two wonderful chapters, one on honeybees and one on bumblebees, with the bumblebees representing wild pollinators of many kinds. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, why they're so important? You even have a fact in there that, what was it, every third mouthful of food that you eat depends on pollinators.
Most of the plants that exist are flowering plants, and most of the flowering plants require things other than wind and water to pollinate them. So they get the services of mostly of insects, and bees are the most obvious example, but there are plenty other species of mosquito, hoverflies, numbers of beetles and so forth. But they will come to drink the nectar and will carry away the pollen. Some things, bees will also take away the pollen on purpose, so the flowers will overproduce pollen, and some of it will get transferred from flower to flower. That's how plants have sex. That's how they make more plants. And that's all very good. The only snag comes in is if we start killing off the pollinators, which we are doing. If we are creating monocultures using various chemical ways of killing potentially damaging insects. These are indiscriminate and kill lots of other insects as well. Already we're in a situation where we need to take action to pollinate crops in areas of China where the fruit trees are pollinated by people using brushes or cigarette tips to move the pollen from one flower to another. But the problems are, how are you going to keep your domestic honeybees alive in an agricultural system that uses so many insecticides?
Well, we're about out of time, but I did want to finish, you know, with throughout your book, there's definitely a conservation theme where, you know, we at our own peril as a species, we will not survive without our fellow life on Earth. And you make that abundantly clear in your epilogue. And I thought that was a nice way to wrap up the book.
No, that's very nice of you to say so. Yes, that was a time when I was in Borneo. It had been a wonderful trip to such rainforest as is left in Malaysian Borneo. And I had this moment where you don't stay up late in rainforest, you're up early, but I couldn't, was not in the mood for sleep. So I just sat out with the forest all around me and the forest noises all around me and the immensity of those trees, those great dipterocarps that reach up to the canopy, listening to the noises of the night, basically feeling life all around me teeming. And I could just feel how it was just this pause in the busyness of life, the business, even if you're trying to work in conservation, just a pause in the busyness of feeling that this is how life should be. Life should be rich, life should be teeming, life should be full of many, many species, and that the future of humanity is to find a way of living with the other species and accepting that if we don't have establish a way of sharing the planet, then our own future is drastically compromised. But I felt that in the piece of that of the Rainforest Night, I felt very much that this was how things should be, and perhaps even how things could be. All it will take is the most monstrous effort of will. But if we don't make that effort of will, we're all in trouble.
Yes, we disconnect from nature at our own peril. Well, Simon Barnes, the author of A History of the World and 100 Animals, highly recommend the book. A lot of fun to read. And we only touched on a few of the animals. There's so many more in here and so many fun stories. But it was a joy to talk to you. Thanks for being on the show.
Very nice talking to you, Dave. Thank you very much for everything. I'm deeply delighted that you enjoyed the book.
Well, and thanks for giving Matt advice on his blue jay problem.
That as well.
Thanks again to our guest, British journalist and author Simon Barnes. His new book, A History of the World in 100 Animals, is a delightful read, and I highly recommend it to anyone interested in nature and animals. It's published by Pegasus Books and available at most major booksellers. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at blue.nspr. Our social media coordinator is Angela Ostarello. The theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.